Okay, the person who invented the selfie was Mr. Bean before mobile phones were invented. Obviously, there was the Simpsons one, animal selfies, and you get charity ones as well, don't you? Who did the ice bucket challenge? That's a selfie in form, isn't it, really? Whichever charity you were raising money for. I guess they're perfectly harmless, aren't they? Maybe it will interfere with your studies, year 13s. This time of year is very crucial. But I think they neatly sum up our culture in that today we have a very individual perspective on life. I is central. We've been kind of fed this mass media message that life is all about us. And unfortunately, and I say we've been fed, because that's me as well, that's the kind of the worldview that we live and breathe, isn't it? That we are so much at the center of everything. And people who do sociology, some of you will know that kind of stuff, and study people and groups in society, what have you. Some of the very clever people who do sociology and study people like yourselves, they have called us Generation Me. Oh, man, it takes a doctorate to come up with a term like that. That's really hard work. But I guess that's how we've been subtly shaped, isn't it? That, you know, we are often all about ourselves. And we've got a whole world to marvel at and to be in awe and wonder about. And yet, we're so busy taking a picture of ourselves and our lovely pouting faces. And I just wanted you to think back to the last time you were somewhere really beautiful, kind of outside, I'm talking about, somewhere picturesque, whether it's like a mountainside kind of thing, or you're kind of by the sea on a beach or the top of a cliff or something. And what do? We try and get a photo of ourselves with that in the background and edit it in the best way so that we can, when we get signal, that actually if you're stood by the sea, you often get really good signal, so that we can upload it to Facebook or Instagram or what have you. And we're so busy thinking about ourselves that we're not drinking in this amazing kind of vista, this view of the world. And if we're not busy taking photographs of ourselves, then we're being bombarded with messages from maybe our parents or people at school that you've got to get your grades, got to work hard and get your grades. You've got to get out there and earn money. You've got to look the best you can. Maybe that one comes from the media. You've got to find your perfect partner. You've got to do all this. And we're a generation that are absolutely soaked, saturated to the skin with messages of the I generation. And what that can form in us is this whole kind of thing of our self-importance, that we are king, that our own sense of happiness and fulfillment in life becomes the goal, is the destination. Now, in the brief time that I've got tonight, and I'm sure you'll be glad that it will be brief, whilst I'm not going to say anything about whether you should, I'm going to move this before I tread on it, about whether you should take selfies or not, that's up to you. But what I do want to talk about is this whole thing of selfie rule and what that's got to do with being part of Jesus' church and even coming to believe in Jesus for the first time. So firstly, I'm going to think about being a follower of Jesus in the age of the selfie. So that's where we're going for the next bit. Because when you look at the New Testament in the Bible, the recorded bits about Jesus and the first group of Christians, the church, some 2,000 years ago, we see that the church was never designed to be a series of individuals. It was never about me, but it was always about us. And for those of us here tonight who are sort of would claim that we're followers of Jesus, Christians, how do we see what being part of the church is all about? It's an interesting question which I would like you to think about. I ask that because so often church can fall into the trap of our culture, the society, thinking in terms of I instead of we or us. But when you go back to the book and you look at those early Christians, that first church realized that the best way to explore this story of Jesus and what that meant to live for that person was through community. The best way to change the world was by sticking together, standing by each other and supporting one another. And we see a little glimpse of this in Acts chapter 2. If we can go to Acts chapter 2, which is the next slide. I'll read this out for you. All who believed were together and had all things in common. And they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all. It's amazing. I've got eyes in the back of my head, haven't I? As any had need. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved. Now that's a massive difference, isn't it? They were a community of different people who were bound together by their shared followership of Jesus. They were people who were literally doing life every day, eating meals together, praying and reading the scriptures together, having fun together, hanging out as people who were on a journey to become more like Jesus. And it's more than just being part of the crowd, isn't it? You can even come to something like this, the point, and just be part of the crowd. But by being connected and on a journey with people, that doesn't happen in big gatherings. We have to connect in smaller groups, in smaller units, and get to know people. And it's kind of what Kat and Timmy were talking about earlier. So to not live the Christian faith as selfie means to get plugged in to a local church or a local church youth group. At the very least with people of your own age, and go on that journey. And I've got a few reasons that are going to flick up on the screen here about why it's good to get connected into your local church community. Lots of you have been away with us to Letton and come to the point, and Crops really believes in the local church and believes that we should. I go to a local church, I'm part of a local church, and I really do think it's a good thing to be connected in to a local church. So the first one here, being in community, Christian community, identifies you as a genuine believer. Now the Bible uses many metaphors, pictures, and says a Christian without a church home is like an organ without a body. I'm not talking about a musical organ like that, but like, you know, the heart or the lungs or what have you, sort of being detached from the body. Or it's like a sheep without a flock, a child without a family. It's basically an unnatural state. There's a verse there, Ephesians 2:19. Now you are no longer strangers to God and foreigners to heaven, but you are members of God's very own family, citizens of God's country, and you belong in God's household with every other Christian. I guess our world and its culture of kind of independent individuals, the knock-on effect is that it's created many spiritual orphans, bunny believers is what some people call them, who kind of hop around from one place to another and without any real identity or commitment. And it's good to find a church, commit to it, and be part of it. I can't claim to be following Christ if I'm not committed to a specific group of Christians. Jesus said that when we love one another, it will prove to the world that we are his disciples. Okay, that's the first thing. Number two, being in community, Christian community, the church, helps you grow spiritual muscle. Now, that's an interesting one, isn't it? There's a lot of people here in this room I know like to go and work out at the gym. Decker and Jay, their little dream team, you know, going there to the gym. Sometimes they work so hard that they come out and be sick. It's true. But do we think about developing our spiritual muscle. We'll never grow as Christians just by attending worship events in the summer or what have you, and being a spectator. Being connected in and involved in the life of the church, of a church, will help us to grow. Great verse here in Ephesians 4:10. As each part does its own special work, it helps the other parts grow so that the whole body is healthy and growing and full of love. Now, a little thought on this. Christian community, here's a little phrase, is the classroom for learning how to get along in God's family. Because if you're going to spend time with people each week, you're going to rub shoulders, aren't you, with people? And if you're sharing your life with people, you're going to rub shoulders with people. And it's like, it's not always going to be really fun and great. Sometimes we're going to wind each other up, or, you know, as you get to know someone, you're like, actually, that bit, that what you do there really annoys me and what have you. And it can be, it's like family life, isn't it? Now, most of you know, or you might not do, I have two children, Reuben and Anna. A lot of you would have met them when they've been at Letton. And you'll know that they're angels, that they behave impeccably on every occasion. Well, that's what you might think. If you were a fly on the wall in our house of an evening or a morning or a lunchtime or what have you, then you would see some different things. I just kind of thinking to this morning, one incident where kind of there was a little bit of a discussion going on about something, and Anna was trying to get into Reuben's room and sort of pushing on the door. She happened to have her fingers in the door frame at this very moment, and Reuben was trying to read something, and he was getting a bit frustrated. I think it's his joke book. He's got one of those. Have you seen those like little calendars for each day, and they've got a joke for each day? He's got one of those, so it always comes and starts telling me a joke. And I'm like, how do you know all these jokes? And I think, oh, we bought that for you for Christmas 3 years ago. He uses it every year, and he shoved the door shut, and there was a loud scream. He didn't know her hand was in there. Well, that's what he claimed anyway. But you know, round the dinner table. We like to do highlight of the day, where we talk about what, you know, something which has been really celebratory, you know, worth talking about, what have you. And sometimes, you know, one person starts talking, and then the other person's talking over them, and that's just me and Esther. It can get a bit sparky, but that's normal, isn't it? That's family life, and it's in those real time relationships that. We learn to get on, or we should do. That's what a good family should be about. And it's the same as growing as a Christian. You can't do that if you're not in relationship, friendships, committed with other Christians. You might think that you can grow as a Christian just by going to the, you know, Amazon or the Christian bookshop and buying books about it and listening to podcasts of preachers and what have you. But and you get a lot of good things from those things, listening to Christian music. But to have a faith that is growing, that has to show up in relationships. Okay. I'd even say, don't hear me wrong, don't hear what I'm not saying. That's an interesting one. We need more than the Bible to grow. The Bible's very important, and our lives need to be rooted in the Bible if we're wanting to be growing Christians. But we need other Christians, and we grow faster and stronger by learning from each other and being accountable, going back to what the guys with United were saying. That's really important. When someone else shares what God is teaching them, I can learn and grow and all that kind of stuff. Okay, number three. Being in community means that we share in Christ's mission in the world. When Jesus was on earth, quite simply, God was working through him. And today, God is using the church, often referred to as the body of Christ, on earth. And yes, we are to model God's love by loving each other. But we're to carry that out together into the world with the people that we meet. And I wonder, you know, kind of how outward looking we are when we meet up with other Christians. imagine if you're part of a youth group, that if you suddenly said, right, we're going to continue to meet each week to encourage each other, but also we're going to kind of think about asking God to show us how we can reach out to people around us, to be thinking outwardly and not just inwardly, a new journey where we will kind of grow together in new ways. And I guess the problem with an individual kind of faith, which is lived out on our own, is that it kind of requires us to be these fully perfected superhero kind of Christians who maybe see ourselves as the answer to the problems in the world. And that's hard to live out. I think it's easier to be Jesus' hands and feet, part of his body, than to try and be the Messiah yourself. It's a big responsibility, isn't it? But instead, we can be a community of people who together can make a difference in the world as we refuse to be the selfie generation. Okay, number four. Being in community helps us from falling away. Okay, now what I'm talking about there is if you're already a Christian and you're sort of walking on the journey of kind of trying to follow God with your life, it's not easy. And none of us are immune to temptation. Given the right situation, we're all capable of doing the wrong thing, falling into sin. And God knows this. He understands that it's not easy to kind of go the right way. And he's put people around us, Christians, who I guess are assigned the responsibility of helping to keep each other on track. Again, that goes back to the accountability thing. It's a great verse there, Hebrews 3:13. Encourage each other every day while it is today. Help each other so none of you will become hardened because sin has tricked you. Good encouragement there. You know, we're actually commanded by the Bible there to be involved in each other's lives. I know some of you here have got your Facebook groups, your message groups, and you know, there's lots of times where you're encouraging each other, praying for each other, talking about how stuff has gone. You know, use all the means that you can to be connected together and to try and help each other. You know, and being honest about your weaknesses and the things that you struggle with, it's a really good thing. And there's that verse in James there about people who've wandered off from God's truth and not writing them off, but trying to help them get back on the road. And maybe God is putting someone on your heart who you know hasn't kind of been part of the youth group for a while or kind of been part of the church group, and you know, God's putting them on your heart because he wants you to pray for them. He wants you to think about how you can make a connection with them again, encourage them, and help them to be part of things again. Because for whatever reason, difficulties, stuff that they're facing, life just overwhelming them, that they've wandered away from Christian community. Maybe kind of you feel like that. Maybe you feel that you haven't really sort of been part of church for a long time, and you know, kind of tonight is like a first step in thinking about God and your relationship with him again. And I'd encourage you just to keep going and keep making those little steps back towards God, and he'll meet you kind of halfway with massive huge steps towards you. I think church is important when it comes to that, because God has put Christian leaders who are there, like pastors, who are like shepherds, to sort of to look after the flock of the sheep, to guard and to protect, to defend God's flock, and they're really important people. And it may sound funny thinking of yourself like a sheep. The Bible uses that image a lot, doesn't it, when talking about Christians. But the reality is that kind of we have an enemy in the spiritual world, the devil, who loves to pick off individual Christian believers and push them away from that group of Christians, to get them on their own, to get them unplugged from the life of the body in Christ. And by being committed in and connected in with a church, it helps keep us strong and helps keep us on that mission, help keeps us growing. Okay, I'm going to have a quick drink for a moment because my throat's getting dry. Everyone stand up and go on, stand up for me. I'm going to just ask you to spin around on the spot 2 times. Okay, some of you have done 3, that's fine. You sit down again. Just get the blood flowing and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Okay, so the last thing I want to quickly talk about tonight in this whole kind of selfie rules here, otherwise known as I'm okay, thanks, I can do it myself, which is, I guess, the expression of living for ourselves. There's a slide, do you want to put up the slide, the picture of Muhammad Ali, very famous boxer, and he had this saying, I am the greatest. You can still buy t-shirts, which have, you know, picture of him saying, I am the greatest. It was his little catchphrase. And it's a great story about Muhammad Ali, okay? He joined the peak of his career as the heavyweight boxing champion of the world. I was going to do, you know when they announce these people out into the fight? Heavyweight boxing champion of the world! I could do that, but I won't. Oh, I just did. That was tragic, wasn't it? There we go. Anyway, he was flying interstate across America for one of his title fights, it says here. He was on a flight to a fight. It's a bit of a tongue twister, isn't it? And so he's on this plane flying interstate, and suddenly the captain on the tannoy announces, ladies and gentlemen, will you please fasten your seatbelts? That's almost as good as the announcer announcing Muhammad Ali at the start of the boxing match. Anyway, he goes on to say that they were about to experience this kind of like severe turbulence in the air. And for a captain to be blunt about turbulence, it had to be bad. And immediately everybody did as they were told. That is everyone except Muhammad Ali. He was sitting confidently up there in first class with his seatbelt undone. Now, obviously on an aeroplane in those days, I'm sure it's still the case today, you have your flight attendants who come round and serve you drinks and check that everyone's happy and what have you. And in those kind of situations, they have to do all these little security checks and check that everyone's got their seatbelts on. So when the flight attendant comes round to check that everyone's got their seatbelt on, this lady, she sees Muhammad Ali and she says, sir, the captain has asked us to fasten our seatbelts. We're about to enter a storm and it could be dangerous. And he replies with this, Superman don't need no seatbelt. And quick as a flash, the flight attendant answers him like this. And she says, Superman don't need no aeroplane. And the arrogance that, you know, 10 kilometers up in the air, in this great big piece of aluminium, because that's basically what an aeroplane is, isn't it? In the middle of this dangerous storm, to say that you don't need a seatbelt, the reality was he needed that seatbelt as much as anybody else. In fact, he needed that flight attendant and the captain and also the plane to get him down safely. And when it comes to whether we are a generation selfie or not, for some of us, the hardest thing in the world is to admit our own weakness and our failure and that we're putting ourselves as number one in life. And despite all good sense, we pretend to be Superman or Superwoman. And this is particularly the case when it comes to faith. For some bizarre reason, some of us, and I include myself at times, have thought, I'm doing fine on my own. I don't need God. And the more I think about that, the more it sounds like Muhammad Ali in the middle of that storm. And I don't know about you, but I can't make it on my own. Now, go to the next slide, please. That would be fantastic. Picture of the three crosses. 2,000 years ago, by about 10 a.m. Friday morning, three men found themselves in front of a large crowd, nailed hand and foot to huge wooden cross-like structures. They were naked, bleeding, dying. Each of them was being executed for very serious crimes. One of them for the most serious crime. It was the end of the line for these three people. No more ambitions, no more parties, no more friendships, and in several hours there would be no more breathing. You would think that in a situation like this, that all three men would be feeling quite unsuper. Now, amazingly, though, one of them refuses to face up to the reality of the situation. Not only is this man experiencing the shame and the agony of being crucified in front of an audience, he's about to meet his maker. He's in serious trouble. And instead of coming to his senses, though, he turns to the man being crucified in the middle, about 5 or 10 meters away, and starts yelling abuse at him. And we read in the gospel account, one of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at Jesus, saying, "Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us." Now, from about 5 or 6 in the morning that day, leaders, politicians, soldiers, and Pontius Pilate have all been abusing Jesus and making fun of his claim to be the Christ. And now this dying criminal joins in. He joins a long line of people that day who made a terrible mistake in falsely judging Jesus. And his words say it all. This man thinks he has no need of Jesus. Perhaps he also thinks that he's Superman. And what's amazing about this event is the reaction of the second man being crucified on the other side of Jesus. As soon as he hears the insulting words from the other criminal, he yells to him, "Don't you fear God, since you are under the same penalty. We are punished justly, for we are getting what we deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong." This criminal, unlike the other, knows he is about to meet his maker. He understands that it's not time to play Superman, but that it's time to fasten the seatbelt and listen to the flight attendant. In other words, it's time to be honest about his weaknesses and his failures. And I don't know about you, but that can be hard, can't it, to be honest about the fact that we've messed stuff up. I remember, I think it was last summer, I was walking from my house with my daughter Anna, and she had a little bike, a little pink bike with the sparkly bits on it. And she can ride the bike at this point. And she was on the pavement and was cycling in front of me. And as she went between like this hedge and some parked car, she slightly tipped to the right, and the corner of her handlebar caught this lovely Vauxhall Insignia, which was quite new at the time, and it put quite an obvious scratch on the top of the bonnet. And I was like, and we were walking the dog at the time, and we sort of came back, and I was like, "Do you know what? I don't think anyone saw us. And, you know, we could probably just go home and it would all be okay," kind of thing. And I was thinking, no, that's not the right thing to do, is it? And what's that teaching Anna and all that kind of stuff? So we got back home and we had a little chat about it. And I was like, you know, I know you didn't mean to knock into the car and everything and you weren't going that fast, but I had a look and it has got a scratch on it. And I think we probably should go and, I know whose car it is, go and knock on the door and tell them that it was us. So we went round there, and I did the talking, you know. And knocked on the door and what have you, and the chap comes out, and, you know, it was quite hard to say to someone that you've just marked their car, what have you. And he was really good about it, actually, and I was like, it's like, "Don't worry, it's a company car. They'll sort it." And but he was like, but thanks for coming and telling me. People don't normally do that. And there was a huge sense of relief in going and knocking the door and talking to that person. And there is that sense of relief when we can be honest about something, when we can be honest about the state of our lives before God. And you may not have committed any criminal acts. Well, you may have, I don't know. But the word that Jesus often used, sin, has to do with falling short of God's standards, not our society's laws. And who of us in any way can claim not to have broken God's standards? Who of us can claim that not to have dark things in our lives for which we're ashamed of? I can't. And the word sin, you might have heard this before, the middle letter is I. It's right there in the middle. And you could say that sin is all about putting I in the middle. I as the most important thing. Me being the most important. And I guess when we live our lives like that, that's where it starts to go wrong. And this other criminal does more than admit that he's got it wrong. He does something about it. And we read, and he said to Jesus, "Remember me when you come as king." All that day, many people refused to acknowledge Jesus as the Christ. But this dying man, he begs him. And he says, "Remember me when you come as king." And this criminal can see who Jesus really is. Jesus may be nailed to a cross, dying himself, but he responds in true style. Jesus says, "Today I promise that you will be with me in paradise." Jesus responds with total, unconditional acceptance. No ifs, no buts, no questions, no requirements, no go away and fill this form out or go and, you know, give this money or what have you. He just accepts this guy who's admitted his failure, who has acknowledged that Jesus is king. He asks for God's mercy and he gets it. That's enough. And that's what it means to respond to Jesus.